You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, July 18th, 2007, and this is your host, Stephen Novella, president of the New England Skeptical Society. This evening we're going to have a shorter than usual episode. We have an interview scheduled with Brian Trent coming up in just a moment. And that interview will be the entire show for this week. Unfortunately, this was unavoidable. There were a combination of personal events this week. Skeptical Rogue Jay Novella is getting married in a few days. This we were planning on. We were planning on Jay's wedding, and we were going to try to work around it. However, unfortunately, there was also a death in the family. So the combination of those things did not leave us time to do a full episode. But we're still going to bring you the interview that we had scheduled with Brian Trent. So let's go to that interview now. Joining us now is Brian Trent. Brian, welcome back to The Skeptic's Guide.
Thank you very much. It's great to be back.
Brian is a professional essayist, screenwriter, and novelist, and we interviewed you actually a little over a year ago about your book, Remembering Hypatia, and now we invited you back to discuss some essays that you've written on immortality.
Right. It's been kind of a subject that's interested me lately. My newest book just came out, Never Grow Old, and it deals with a mythological analysis of immortality, but I have also done, you know, scientific readings on it as well. It's been a subject that's interested me for a long time.
Well, you're also a columnist for the American Chronicle, and you do have an article in there on this topic, and you do discuss the history of man's obsession with immortality. So why don't you tell us about that?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, the oldest story that we know of, and actually the story that I used to base my new book on, is the Gilgamesh legend. And this is, you know, back when they were pressing stories into wet clay. It was before scrolls, you know, way, way, way before ancient Greece. And the first story that we know of is about man's obsession with immortality. It's been, as far as we know, from the dawning of sentience with our species and the dawn of our civilization, this is a subject. Our recognition of our own mortality and the desire to increase our longevity and our life and to remain existent is something that's obsessed us for a long time. In ancient China, the first emperor, Qin Shi Huangdi, was obsessed with immortality. He sent people all around the world to find the elixir of life. Had his body encased in a full suit of jade from head to toe, because they would believe that jade was the bone marrow of Pangu, the creator god. It would have regenerative properties. The Egyptians are an obvious example. I mean, they're just a lot of stock in the idea of immortality, even though it didn't work out very well for them, since even though they would remove all the organs of the body and put them very carefully into another jar, they would discard the brain.
Right. That was an unimportant organ. Scrape it out through the nose, throw it away, yeah.
But it's gone into everything. I mean, literature, one of the lesser-known adventures of Gulliver on Gulliver's Travels was he went to an island of immortals where people would live forever, but they would keep aging. Mm-hmm. So you had these people who would become these, you know, babbling, helpless idiots, but they would be around forever, and they were just sucking up all the island's economy and to try to take care of them and keep them fed. And because they wouldn't die off, you just had that population of mortals ever increasing and ever, you know, destroying what society they had, which I think is pretty far-sighted of Jonathan Swift to write something like that, because that's obviously one of the concerns. If some of the new scientific explorations into this subject turn out to bear fruit, it's a relevant philosophical and cultural and political subject in time.
So. Was that a prevalent topic in his day? Because I know a lot of the islands that Gulliver visited was basically a commentary on society. So how did that really apply to his contemporary society when he wrote that?
Yeah, and not that I was able to cover. I mean, Swift, Swift is, I think, I consider him one of the true literary geniuses. I mean, he's, and he also was a hopeless misanthrope. His views on humanity were extremely dismal. It's almost hard to read some of his work sometimes because he has such a such a dark view of human nature. But he also was, like I said, very far-sighted, and he's just analyzing the different islands. Each one of those islands, like you said, provided him an opportunity to analyze religion, government, war, different aspects of culture. So I think it just came in time. He might have been thinking that far ahead. He might have been certainly, you know, people have been obsessed with the idea of immortality since Gilgamesh. Mm. So it may have crossed his mind, but that certainly allowed him. It's a very relevant metaphor that he left us. I believe it was, I think they were called the Strolldbrugs or something like that was the name of the island. It's been some time since I've read the book, but I do recall that very, very vividly. So.
But it does bring up a point that you also write about, which is, you know, we could talk about the scientific question of immortality in a moment, but right. You also write about just the impact that this would have on society, on civilization, and the reactions that different segments of civilizations are likely to have to the prospect of immortality.
Right. It's a subject. I mean, I'm a fan of scientific progress. I'm a fan of a lot of humanistic philosophies, and you know, certainly I consider death, aging and death, to be a mechanical problem that can be solved through mechanical means. But I mean, that doesn't make me blind to the very real conundrums and the very real ramifications of that research. I mean, as I mentioned, I think that was the article too that I mentioned, where, you know, what do you do when you have an immortal board of directors in a company?
Mm-hmm.
You know, or you have senators who have languished in the Senate of a particular country for 500 years. You know, what happens to are the arts when you don't have the mortality has been a muse for music, for writing, for so much. One thing I suggested was that, much as Anne Rice implied and explored with her vampire novels, the idea of something that would, an immortal sentient being might find, you know, things plenty to be upset about, you know, because you're still, even though you're not necessarily dying, it's not your own mortality you're exploring, the world around you still changes. You're a constant in a universe that is defined by change. Certainly when you consider the laws of entropy and the fact that very you, the stars are going to burn out, you know, our star itself has, you know, it's like an arrow shot. I mean, its timeline, the hourglass has been turned. It's not going to be there forever. So, I believe that as a species, we'll still find plenty of things to motivate us artistically. Of course, if I'm wrong, you're looking at more or less the calcification of progress and the calcification of inspiration.
Well, death, even if we were immortal, death would still happen. I mean, there would be catastrophic accidents and maybe even suicide. So, I mean, I think that would make death even more tragic and something that could, you know, artisans can treat as a muse. Imagine how tragic a death would be if somebody dies when they're 50, when you know they could have lived for millennia. It's still a tragic thing.
Right. That's a very valid point. I know when I spoke to Michael Rose at the University of California at Irvine about his research on breeding quote-unquote immortal fruit flies, and he talked about the idea there was still a mortality distribution curve. Unless you're going to get into more transhumanist ideas about, I'm not a big fan of some of the ideas of that community, but you know, it's difficult to predict. To science, it's very difficult to predict where things might go. I find some of the arguments very counterproductive, quite frankly, whether or not they're right. But it's the idea of digitally, you know, the construction of our minds is a physical thing, even though pop culture and certainly religion has the idea that there's this spiritual dimension to it. So if it is a physical entity with neural synapses and the construction through our lives of bridges that have been built as our reflexes develop and as we encode memories, could that be transferred digitally? So would you always have backup copies of a certain mind? Would the future Albert Einstein or future Joe Citizen be preserved digitally so that there really would be no final death?
Yeah, the medium isn't all important. It's really the pattern that's really important. It doesn't matter if it's in, you know, it doesn't have to be this electrochemical substrate. It could be silicon or something much more exotic.
It could be, but
right.
But it's not just the pattern, though. I mean, I don't think that our existence is simply a pattern. It's a combination of the pattern and the hardware. The question is, could we migrate our consciousness over to another medium without losing the actual continuity of the self?
Right. That's a key concern in my mind, is the continuity. I don't care if they were able to duplicate my mind in any other medium and then destroy the biological residue. I mean, that residue is me. It would have to be – you'd have to maintain continuity, and that's why some of the ideas I've heard about where it's a slow metamorphosis of your biological brain into something, you know, more hardy and the new substrate, that's appealing to me, because there wouldn't be any break where you exist in two places, or you don't exist and they recreate you, type of thing.
Yeah, there would be a period as a hybrid where you were both biological and digital, and then eventually the digital you would predominate over the biological. But at every point, it's still you. Otherwise, as you say, you just get a clone who may have all of your memories and everything, but isn't a continuation of yourself. But for civilization, that wouldn't really matter. It would still be entities with memories hundreds or thousands of years old that are inhabiting our civilization.
But it's funny, because when we talk about immortality like that, we don't usually think in terms, or at least I don't, think in terms of what would be best for society, like keeping a hold of the memories of these individuals. Instead, I think about what would be best for me living on and
absolutely.
On.
Me, me, me.
Yeah, there's no denying that there is a selfish driving force behind that. Even going back to, you know, the Gilgamesh legend, it was when Gilgamesh loses his friend Enkidu, he goes off in search of immortality because he is totally devastated, you know, completely ripped apart. This is one of his best friend in life, but he's not looking for immortality for himself because he doesn't want to suffer that same fate. So, yeah, I mean, sir, I certainly agree with Rebecca. I mean, it definitely does have that idea that it is a selfish thing. But on the other hand, I mean, we're blessed and cursed to be, as far as we know, the most remarkable species to ever evolve on this world. 500 million years of life.
And just to clarify, so we don't get any emails, you're referring to multicellular life.
And you've had very successful species like the dinosaurs and other organisms which have lived and died and changed, but in such a short period of time of our species, of, you know, upright walking hominids, and then of course the very, very, very short history of our civilization, which you can trace back to, you know, 5,000 BCE, maybe a little more, for it depends on, you know, who you consult and, you know, the different records and different cities they unearth. But we've done so much in such a short period of time. It's kind of it is a curse in a way that we're so keenly aware of how fragile we are. You know, we forced our way to the top of the food chain. We didn't have natural armor. We didn't have poison sacks. We weren't these bulky titans. We were, frankly, a fallen ape in a way that had to stand upright to look over the tall grasses to survive in the savanna region of Africa. And just happens to have freed up our hands, we could start using tools. And throughout this whole process, we've constantly remade our environment. We're the ultimate shapers. We, you know, cut down trees and build a house. We defy nature. We defy the elements every chance we get. And I frankly celebrate that. I mean, winter is, you know, a deep freeze that happens in this world and species are callously killed off. Well, we defy that. We become little Prometheuses. We light our fires. We persist through the glacial ages. We persist through whatever is thrown our way. So the idea that us expanding our lifespan to points like that, to quote-unquote indefinite, I mean, you know, it's a flashy, sensationalist term, immortal, but the idea is longevity research, you know, continuing our way beyond the 7, 8, maybe 9 decades that we are granted by nature's design, I think is inevitable. I think it's something that is a very important scientific problem, probably, as far as we're concerned, maybe the most important one right now.
Right. Yeah, we're hitting a lot of points that I want to come back to. One was, you know, as Rebecca mentioned, the difference between what's good for the self and what's good for civilization, and that, I think, is at the crux of a lot of this. I mean, you could argue that our mortality, as you were saying, it has a lot of strengths for society, for civilization. There's constantly, you know, like new people coming up with new ideas and fresh eyes on the world, and the old and stodgy and calcified are moved out of the way so to make room for what's new. And what would be the long-term impact of having scientists controlling the upper echelons of science, but locked into their ways of thinking that are maybe centuries old. There's a quip which I think is a bit outdated, but it goes that, you know, science progresses on the deaths of those who came before. So new ideas only take hold when the people who are clinging to the old ideas die off. To the extent that that's true, extremely long lifespans would impede progress, you know, in because it would lock in these old ideas.
Of course, that does bring up an interesting question as well. Does, you know, you look at Isaac Newton, you look at a lot of luminaries throughout history, Archimedes and so forth, who accomplished things very early in their lives. And historically, in the, especially the history of science, a lot of discoveries seem to be made by people who are in their 20s or in their 30s. But is it because people gradually get older? Is it not that it's so it's set in their ways so much as just, you know, whatever driving OCD or whatever it was but was really pushing them onward to be fanatical about something? Do they kind of, as their bodies age, as they settle into settle into older, you know, eras of their lives, do they just kind of calm down and that spark, that burning kind of tends to evaporate a little bit? Or is it just people do get set in their ways no matter what, and they're not open to new ideas because they harden like those old Mesopotamian clay tablets?
Yeah, I mean, that's a really good point, because there actually is a neurological basis for...
Right, I read a study about this.
You know, people getting set in their ways. Yeah, you know, there's a pruning effect that goes on in the brain where you lose neurons, you lose the ability to make entirely, you know, new pathways, etc. So from a purely neurological basis, the brain becomes set in its ways. And what if, again, through, you know, bioengineering, we can fix that? Would people keep a more youthful outlook and a more, like, more nimble mental picture of the world if they had a brain that was perpetually 20 years old? That's something that I don't think we're going to know until we get there.
Yeah, that pruning seems like a form of pathology to me, Steve. That's something that we would address if we were. I mean, if we were to make ourselves live indefinite lifespans, I mean, I wouldn't want to make myself equivalent to a 50-year-old. I'd make myself, you know, biologically equivalent to a 25-year-old.
Right, but and when that happens, then we'll have a much better notion of how much of the stodginess of old age is neurological and how much is just psychological. It's just that you've been there and done that, you've done everything, and you're set in your ways, and you're too tired to change.
Right, but it's still no reason not to pursue this. Some of these problems that people have with it, like the, you know, the ossification of your, you know, your psychology, or the overpopulation, these things that I think we will address, and they're not deal killers for me in any way.
Right. I agree completely with that. I think that the problems, you know, we have a habit of, you know, survival. We when we're confronted with challenges, we make it work somehow. And overpopulation and other issues that come up, I think we'll deal with them in due time. And historically, you expand to alleviate overpopulation pressures, but there's also things kind of balance out. There's the equilibrium that's established, and people probably wouldn't be having kids as frequently. I agree with you. They're not deal killers.
Yeah, I agree. And we also, there's some potential upsides to this in that, imagine, you know, having people around who are 500 years old or 1,000 years old. That's a living history and a living memory that could be invaluable. And just imagine the potential wisdom and insight, you know, that such longevity could produce. I mean, that could actually become an incredible resource for civilization and for humanity.
Although, what about the ability to forget things? I mean, when you're 500 years old, what do you fiddle around with in the brain to make sure that it holds on to certain memories? But in the end, you know, sometimes it's kind of nice to forget things.
Forgetting is absolutely crucial. If we didn't forget, we would go absolutely nuts.
Yeah.
Right. So, I mean, that would be a huge hurdle where you've got, yeah, somebody who's lived for 500 years, but they're only going to be crystal clear on the memory of the last 10 or so.
That's a great point. That's great. You guys recall the movie Strange Days with Rob Fiennes?
Yeah.
It was where they could record memories and then play them back. And Angela Bassett makes a great point with just what Rebecca said, was one of the characters in the movie is so obsessed with reliving old memories, and she says to him something to the effect of, memories were designed to fade. They're built like that for a reason.
Mm-hmm. So, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is another good movie about
that's
that.
That's true.
I have to see that,
FYI.
Yeah.
So we may be living in like a 50-year window that's moving through time, and memory.
But,
or
but even that
years.
Will change. Even that is totally ephemeral because you know if you say these things are going to happen, then we'll also be in some ways, even if in minor ways initially, augmenting mind and memory such that. That there won't be any fading. I mean, that's just something. That's another form of.
But yeah, that's
or maybe
what we're
we won't
saying.
Want to that do that, be, right?
Yeah,
and or people could choose. People may decide they want a little freshening up of the mind, and you know, and clearing out of the closets, the mental closets, and fading away some of the older memories.
I'm a pack rat. I could never do that.
Offload the memories to some external hard drive. It's like, yeah, I'm going to forget about these for a little while. I want to watch that movie for the first time again, you know, and
right.
You watch the movie.
Yeah,
that's fine. I mean, hey, I mean, it's going to get boring after a while. You might as well get some freshness back into the mix.
Yeah, if somebody spoils Harry Potter for you, you
there
can
you
just
go.
Rewind, erase,
just stay off the net.
Brian, on another point, the gods are adorned with many qualities, you know, vulnerability, infallibility, but immortality is one of their prime powers. So what happens to faith if humans start becoming effectively immortal?
A lot of organized religion strength is obviously derived, you know, by the dual roots of fear of death and, you know, the promise of something beyond that. So when you take that away, when you're saying, well, this is the world we know for certain, and this is what we can keep this. There's that need, I think, is negated to a point. I suspect that people have I'm curious what you think about this, but I suspect that people have a need for some kind of spirituality. I think we enjoy our monsters, we enjoy our mythology, we enjoy creating myths, no matter what. I mean, the techno myth even. I mean, the old gods are gone, but there's, you know, there's creatures in the wilderness, there's aliens in a hangar somewhere. We still create that, we still have a love for that, we do. I think we still like the hero worship in a certain way, but I definitely think it would be a death knell to the religions that we know today. I mean, certainly, if history teaches us nothing else, governments come and go, civilizations come and go, religions come and go. You know, I don't think that the ancient Greeks ever really thought that Zeus would not be worshipped, that, you know, goats and lambs and cows would not be sacrificed to him at some point in the future. So I suspect the same thing will happen. I see spirituality becoming more, maybe more earth-based, maybe more reality-based.
Well, even dispelling the very great motivator and fear of death with regards to religion, you still are stuck with the mystery of creation, the other end of things. You still need answers for that. And I think people will still stretch, as you say.
That's true. We might never get a good handle on that. But regarding religion and faith, I don't think they have to be diametrically opposed. I think that you could still have faith in a God and an afterlife, because we throw around the word immortality, but it's a bit of a misnomer. I mean, you could talk about philosophical immortality, but practically, you're not going to live forever with any of the technologies that seem to have some potential. I mean, some people have even put estimates that if you look at statistics, you will live between 1,200 and 5,000 years, because eventually something catastrophic is going to happen to you. A meteor is going to land on you. Something's going to happen eventually. The longer you live, chances are it's going to happen. So, but even if you discuss things like, say, backing up your mind and making 1,000 copies and going to the four winds, you could extend that greatly, I think. But eventually, say there's a few of you left, and at the heat death at the end of the universe, you're going to die one way or the other eventually. So you could always say, well, I'm going to live a billion years, but eventually I'll die and then I'll go to heaven. I mean, so I don't think it's an either or thing.
But the fear of death won't be there if you know you can live a ridiculous amount of time.
Right.
You know, human perspective, or as long as you want. And so I do think that the emotional sort of desire and need for this belief in an afterlife will diminish with this. But I also agree with Brian that religions will evolve and adapt to this changing, you know, psychology and the changing situation of human existence, just as they have.
It could have a very positive impact on religion in one way. One mode of thinking about it might be, well, God has decided to give us immortality, and now this is heaven. Basically,
right. So
we're living heaven on earth,
so let's make
it
good.
The best of it.
Right.
Yeah.
Make it good, exactly. That's, and you know something, they won't be sacrificing themselves for, you know, to get, you know, a few score virgins in some afterlife.
That's a good point. I mean, suicide bombing, you know, will take on a different meaning if you're giving up hundreds or thousands of years of life, you know, and not just expecting, he's giving up a few decades.
But still, there'd be people that wouldn't accept it, wouldn't join the club, and they would still and of course they would die, and there'd only be immortals left. But there, it's amazing to think that.
I was saying, in a way, it almost be like a, not that it was imposed, but what you're talking about, yes, there would always be people. Those would be your Amish, you know, the equivalent of that in the future, the whatever they call themselves, the naturals or the, you know, pure births. But in a way, there would almost be a social Darwinism of sort. Not that I'm advocating such a thing at all, but I'm just saying I think it would sort of happen that those people would die off and, you know, their children or their grandchildren would kind of join the fold of this extraordinarily long-lived human community.
It certainly would be a huge lure. I mean, you know, when you start to get 70, 80 and your body is falling apart, and it's right there, the elixir of life, the ability to rejuvenate and be young again, you know, you'd have to have a pretty strong ideology to pass that up, I think.
But we know how strong ideology can be.
I know, it's true, and I'm not saying that it wouldn't exist, but it'd be interesting to see how that plays out. It'd be a very interesting experiment. I do think that society in general will evolve and will adapt to this, just like, as we said, religions are. Like, getting back a little bit to some points you brought up before about, you know, becoming calcified in your profession, and Brian, you wrote about, like, what would the marriage vow of till death do us part mean in this type of situation? But I think those institutions will just adapt. I think, you know,
Absolutely.
People will start to think of a career, a marriage, whatever, in terms of, this is what I'm doing for the next 50 years, and then after that, all bets are off.
I'll have
and we might even, like, really strongly encourage or force people to switch professions. Like, you've been a geologist for 100 years. You have to stop now and make way for other people. You're done.
That's interesting, yeah.
Negotiating a term of service. You'd fall in love, oh, sure, you know. But you would negotiate a term of service for the marriage. Maybe it would be like, well, with the other 50 years, and if we want to renew, well, the option is there.
50 years with an option, right? Well, you'd have to think in those terms, I think.
I'd like to re-up, but you need to work out some.
Take this exercise pill.
Lose 10 pounds.
What do you see as being the major source of opposition to this?
Well, aside, I mean, two things. I mean, obviously, the mechanical problems themselves. I mean, we've identified, you know, the Hayflick limit. We know about oxidation. We know there are certain things, but these are, unfortunately, the way we deal with these, they have negative effects right now. I mean, they have, you know, the unraveling of chromosomes, the telomeres. You know, they have telomerase, mm-hmm. I think it's called, which is supposed to repair that, but it has carcinogenic side effects. So, I mean, obviously there's a certain mechanical problem. But honestly, the major problem is absolutely ideological.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's, when I talk to people about it, and again, I'm not a transhumanist, I find it to be very interesting, and I think it's certainly a very worthwhile pursuit of the scientific community. But it seems where we're leading anyway, but a lot of people just can't wrap their minds around the very idea of that. A lot of people balk at it. They don't want to even think of it in terms of that, because I think they've been brought up ingrained, like it's hardwired at this point through so much conditioning and through the idea that death is inevitable. I mean, one of the article that you've been referring to, Steve, is I wrote, a lot of the inspiration behind writing that came from reading Marcus Aurelius' book, Meditations. And he's probably one of the most enlightened rulers we've ever had in history, certainly one of the best Roman emperors. And he wrote this book, and time again, on almost every third page, he's drilling home the idea that death is inevitable. You know, yesterday we're a blob of semen, tomorrow we're going to be embalming fluid and ash. And it's so pathological, this repetition of this idea. I just got the impression that he was really trying to convince himself and trying to come to terms with, I think he lived 57 years, so he's coming to terms with the death of himself in time. And I thought about, you know what, is it that inevitable, really? I mean, if it is a mechanical problem, certainly the people used to live, we were hunter-gatherers. I've read that the life expectancy was at the most like 25 years. And I mean, now, you know, we can expect 70, 80, 90 years. It's something that's possible. We know people who do. We have people who've reached 122. It was that French woman, I don't recall her name offhand. And even the definitions of death have changed. It used to be where your heart stopped, you were dead.
Right. You stopped breathing, you were dead.
I think it was the man who shot Liberty Valance who, you know, the guy gets shot, the doctor comes over to make sure he's dead, takes a swig of liquor, kicks him in the ribs, up, dead, you know? And now you have defibrillators. They have all kinds of ways of looking at expanding life, and it doesn't necessarily stop immediately, and there are ways to bring people back, and these are things that earlier cultures would certainly think to be sorcery. So I just was thinking about all that, and I thought, it really is the ideological opposition, not even organized. It's just something you talk to people about it, and they haven't even considered it, quite frankly.
And that definition of death, I think this is an important point, how the definition of death has been changing over the decades. And I think you have to look, what's the ultimate definition of death? And for me, it's brain death. When you cannot even infer the structure of your brain, the working structure of your brain, once you pass that boundary, then you are truly dead. Because if you cannot infer what the functioning state was and in such a way, in such a fidelity that your memories would still be intact, once you pass that, then bam, you are irreversibly dead. Nothing short of a time machine can get you back. So I think that's the ultimate goal of the definition of death. When we reach that point, then that's it.
Yeah, that's ultimate theoretical limit of the definition of death. In the meantime, it's a technological definition. It's beyond the point where we could bring somebody back meaningfully. Well, Brian, your new book is Never Grow Old. Is that in stores?
It is, and it's available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble. A lot of it is, you know, it's about that the mythological aspect of the search for immortality, but it also kind of, it's a cry. It is a humanist cry. I mean, Gilgamesh has a couple speeches that I put into the book, which is about he's advised not to do this, and, you know, what are you trying to do? The world couldn't tolerate an immortal race of people. He's like, well, we'll reshape the world. And that's the crux of it. It's like, well, you know, if the world's not going to make room, we will force it to make room. You know, the clustered forests didn't really permit us to have permanent settlements. Well, we cut them down. And it's not necessarily about being so callous to the natural world so much as there's nothing wrong with the most brilliant and sentient species on the planet redefining things to further its own end. And a lot of this, I think, in the end, the final iteration comes back to, you know, would better things come of this or worse things? Does humanity, you know, you're talking about an immortal Adolf Hitler would not be necessarily a good thing. But then again, when you look at the products of humanity, I mean, the Da Vinci's and the Archimedes and the Galen's and the Lord Byron's and the people who have inspired us, the Hypatia's, you know, going back to my first book, I tend to have more of an optimistic view of the human race, you know, at least until I get tailgated in traffic. But generally speaking, I think that we're a good species and we try to do the right thing. When we don't, I think it's through ignorance. I think it's that's all
another subject. Well, Brian, thanks again for joining us. It's always an interesting conversation.
Thanks,
and
Brian.
Good luck with your new book.
Thank you so much, and great talking to you.
All right, take care. Well, that is all we have for this week's show, but we will be back next week with a full regular episode. We also have a very special interview for next week. You are definitely not going to want to miss this. One just brief announcement before we close. I would again like to remind everybody that the Skeptic's Guide and Skeptic is having a get-together on August 11th. This is in Brooklyn, New York, at the Voorhees Auditorium at 186 J Street. It's beginning at noon. We will be recording a live episode of the Skeptic's Guide where our listeners can ask us questions and we will answer them live. We will have a get-together at the Voorhees Auditorium after we record the show. We will be available to meet and greet with our listeners. And then there will also be casual events after the event itself as well. So we look forward to seeing you all there. And of course, we all want to extend a warm congratulations to Jay Novella on his wedding. He, again, is getting married on July 21st. And he is marrying a very lovely girl, Cheryl Wells, who, in fact, is the girl who does the audio introduction to the show. So congratulations, Jay and Cheryl. And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by the New England Skeptical Society in association with the James Randi Educational Foundation. For more information on this and other episodes, please visit our website at www.theskepticsguide.org. Please send us your questions, suggestions, and other feedback. You can use the Contact Us page on our website, or you can send us an email to info@theskepticsguide.org. Theorem is produced by Kinetto and is used with permission. Endless delays.